Look at that.
House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Still got some seats up front over here for folks that are standing. People would like to come sit down. Committee, we have a packed agenda today, per usual. I'm going to give you a quick roadmap of where we're going on today's agenda and for folks in the audience, and then we'll get started. We're going to start with the end of the list. We're going to start with hearings on 2203 and 2704. Then we're going to move back up to the top, do our work sessions on 2801, 2048, skip down to the work session on 3103. We're going to carry over, I'm announcing now, we're carrying over the work sessions on House Bills 2005 and 3030. And then we will go back to the public hearings on the other two remaining bills. Okay? Committee, any questions on that? Long for the ride. Buckle up. All right. We're going to start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2203. I'd like to go up, Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, is it all right if I bring a few other folks up?
Please. We've opened the public hearing on House Bill 2203. If you would like, we can do the other one first. Your pleasure.
Nope, that's perfect, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Greg Smith, and I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes major pieces of Umatilla County, Milton Freewater, Hermiston, Stanfield, Umatilla, Morrow County, Gillum County, Sherman County, and as I like to say, the best parts of Wasco County. What that means is I'll never be able to run for the Senate. Before you is House Bill 2203. This bill came to me about 4 months ago when I was contacted by Umatilla Electric Cooperative wanting to discuss with me some safety concerns that they possibly had. And so, not knowing a lot about the utility industry, not knowing a lot about renewable energy, not knowing a lot about public safety in general as it relates to these type of issues, we convened a work group and we brought Umatilla Electric Cooperative, Renewable Northwest Project, Associated Oregon Counties, the Public Utility Commission, and Portland General Electric together to talk about safety issues as it relates to what we like to call gentie lines. And so before us today are some experts on this issue. I'd like to introduce them to you, if I may. On my left is Varner Seaman. He's with Renewable Northwest Project. To my right, I have Commissioner Larry Givens from Umatilla County. And to my far right, ironically, is Craig Campbell. I'm teasing, Mr. It's always good to have fun. Is Craig Campbell. Mr. Chair, if it's all right, I'd like to turn to Varner and to Mr. Campbell to perhaps share with you what's in this bill.
Excellent. I notice that Mr. Seaman's on your left.
On my left.
Yeah.
Okay. Ironically, again.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I do live in Representative Bailey's district, which has no one on the left who lives there. As we get into...
they have one.
Well, you could share later who that is. As we get into House Bill 2203 and 2704, both are relating to generation tie lines. And being passed out right now, I thought it would be helpful to refer to a picture so you can, this is not a hard engineering document, a little bit more of a cartoon, to represent what we're talking about. When you have, I'm going to point to the little picture here, when you have a wind energy project, it connects to a substation, generally within the project boundary, so on it, within Oregon, on private land, within a wind energy facility. That substation changes the voltage, which we won't get into, of the project, and there's a line that connects that project substation to the transmission grid. Power is then transmitted either within Oregon, within a local area, or potentially over long lines to an export situation, potentially to the California market, to another substation. It's then power goes on to a distribution grid and to your house, or to facilities like where we are today. The only thing we're talking about today in 2203 and 2704 is this section of line right here between, and it could be between either the wind generators themselves or between the substation and the transmission line. This is called the generation tie line, and it's the part that of the electrical grid that connects an individual facility to the transmission grid. What 2203 does is it clarifies who is responsible for the operations and for the safety of of that generation tie line, and for responding to incidents if there were to be, say, a windstorm and the lines would go down. Generally, those generation tie lines are owned by the owners of the wind energy project or the generating project. Those lines would occur and do occur in the service territory of existing incumbent co-ops. The question that we're dealing with in 2203 is, what do you do if it's 4 in the morning, a windstorm has come up, that line is down, and you've got somebody who works for the co-op who's standing there with the deputy sheriff, who may be a part-time deputy sheriff, may have another job, be similar to being a state legislator and kind of going out into your district and saying, gee, I don't know who owns this piece of line, how do we respond to it? What the bill does is it requires the owner of the line to submit to the Public Utilities Commission who owns that. That section of line, who the appropriate 24-hour safety responder is if there's an incident with that line. And if you're going to go build a new line, you have to let the co-op know as you're applying for a permit so they can be aware, and if they would prefer that it go somewhere else, enter into a discussion about how we move forward on it. We think that this is good policy. These are relatively new projects in the state. This is a change in terms of how power generation has occurred over the years to have the new renewable projects coming into the state. We think we had a good process that Representative Smith convened folks for. We're happy to work through these issues, and we are here to speak in favor of 2203. We think it's good policy.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of Umatilla Electric Cooperative, and the Dash 3 amendments have been pretty adequately explained to you. The circumstances that started the bill, we had an orphan line where if there had been a problem where there had been an automobile accident or a storm or something along those lines, being the utility, we would get the phone call. But if we don't know who's responsible for the line, we don't know how to make sure that the power is off before our folks can provide assistance to law enforcement or emergency responders to make sure that they're not at risk as a result of the power still being on. So what the amendment does is it takes care of the problem nicely without creating any undue burdens. It's just a provision of making sure that everyone is aware of who is responsible for those lines. If they change ownership, it makes sure that the independent power provider who owns the line or is changing hands, they provide that information to the PUC. The PUC then in turn hands it over to us so that when we get the inevitable phone call, we have the information on hand. So it's a pretty simple, straightforward bill, and I do want to thank Representative Smith for putting the group together, and quite frankly, the members of the group who are willing to roll up their sleeves and find a solution to a problem in a very amicable and forward-thinking way. So with that, I would like to indicate Umatilla Electric Cooperative support of the Dash 3 amendments to the bill.
Thank you.
Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Johnson, I'm Umatilla County Commissioner Larry Givens, Chair of the Board of Commissioners in Umatilla County, and is also supportive of this bill. In Umatilla County, we did have a line along a stretch of highway. We had numerous citizens want to know who was responsible, how this would be taken care of, would the county be involved, would UAC be involved, would the developer be involved. This clearly identifies a source to go to. It gives the folks a lot of concerns they had, answers a lot of those concerns as to how these issues will be dealt with. We are in support of that. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate it.
So, Mr. Chair, what I would share with you is before you and before your committee are the Dash 3 amendments.
Okay.
This bill was introduced. We've been working through this work group, and as I shared in my initial comments, we received strong support from Umatilla Electric Cooperative, Renewable Northwest Project, Associated Oregon Counties, and the Public Utility Commission. I think we, in Portland General Electric, I think we've worked through the issues, and I think we have a solution that all parties can agree to.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much, and Representative, we appreciate your good work on this. I've heard from many parties how much effort it took to arrange this work group and to get to consensus on this bill. I commend you for that.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
So we have House Bill 2704 after that.
We have one more person signed up to testify on this bill, but if you'd like to stick around, we'll get to 2704 just briefly. Call up Lori Coho, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey. From the committee, my name is Lori Coho, and I'm the Administrator of the Safety, Reliability, and Security Division at the Public Utility Commission here. I'm here to testify on this bill, 2203. You know what the conditions are in the bill, that the routine operational contact information and the emergency contact information is shared with the Public Utility Commission for operators of electric lines. This kind of information is vital to us when we are responding to emergencies, and it's also very helpful to us when we're doing our routine work of enforcing the National Electric Safety Code across the state. We appreciate the work that was done by Representative Smith on getting the group together, and once this bill is signed into law, we will do our part to make sure that we have a process in place to share that information with counties promptly and securely. That's it.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Seeing no further testimony on this bill, close the public hearing on House Bill 2203. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2704. Gentlemen.
Some musical chairs here. Again, thank you, Chair Bailey. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. Back in December, I received a call from Tamara Mabbitt, who's the planning director for Umatilla County, and she started talking about all this land use stuff and the concerns about some court case as it relates to land use stuff. And I have to admit, it didn't make a lot of sense to me. But I know Tamara, and I know that her desire to do things correctly. And so I got a hold of my Commissioner Givens, and we had a conversation. And Commissioner Givens began to explain to me information about this LUBA court case called Chopin versus Umatilla County. And again, it was very fuzzy to me because I'm not a land use expert. And so Commissioner Givens and myself convened a large work group of about 15 to 20 different groups and entities who might be directly tied to Chopin versus Umatilla County. And we held this meeting in Hermiston, Oregon. And at that meeting, I began to learn what the issue is. And if I can just share with the committee briefly, a LUBA court case, Chopin versus Umatilla County, limited local government's ability to properly analyze the impacts of transmission lines. The county encourages developers to co-locate with three or other existing lines. LUBA found that because a portion of the line was located on land zoned EFU, county could not require the developer to locate on less productive farmland. The purpose then, and then we brought this committee together, and we held multiple meetings. And I'm going to turn to the experts here in a moment to share with you what the outcome was of that meeting. But before they do that, what I want you to know is the folks who came together to discuss this issue. We had Renewable Northwest Project, again, Umatilla Electric Cooperative, Associated Oregon Counties, the Department of Energy, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, Umatilla County, Union County, Malheur County, the League of Oregon Cities, and again, Portland General Electric. And from that work group comes the bill that's before you today. And so, Mr. Chair, if it'd be all right, perhaps the experts on this bill can share with you the outcome of our work.
Please.
Commissioner, would it be all right if we...
Please, Commissioner.
Again, I'm Umatilla County Commission Chair Larry Givens. Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Johnson. Before you, you should have a copy of a letter of support from Umatilla County. And rather than, I can, if you would like, read that, or I'm sure you can go over it on your own, but I would paraphrase a couple of items in that. The purpose of this bill, from the Umatilla County standpoint, was to create an incentive to locate the term gentie lines, and actually in the bill itself, those are not referred to as gentie, they're referred to as associated facilities. The purpose was to create on lands, these locate on lands that are not productive farmland. In other words, saving and keeping those resource lands for farming and for the purpose they were intended. The bill will help foster more sensible siting of transmission lines and slow the proliferation of transmission line being constructed across high-value farmland. And as all of us know today, the state's renewable portfolio standards have increased the reliance on renewable energy throughout the state. And as we look across the state, we see more and more connecting lines, these associated transmission lines, from the generation project to the transmission grid, not only in Umatilla County, but also in other areas across the state. The bill provides and has a clear path for lines not located on productive farmlands, and where a line or a portion of a line must be located on productive farmlands, there are clear and objective standards for doing so, and that was something developers wanted. They wanted a clear standard that they could be assured of. As Representative Smith had testified earlier, he had assembled a diverse group. We did have that group come to a consensus. It took many months to come to that consensus, but we did have that happen. The stakeholder groups intended to make clear that for lines located wholly on non-productive farmlands, the application would not be a land use decision. It would be done administratively by the governing body, in this case, the county. That would thereby limit the ability to appeal that decision. And Legislative Council had removed that language, but it is our hope that the intent is clear, that where it is not on productive farmland, it's not a land use decision. Of course, the term arable land in the bill, 2704, is intended to match the term as found in the Administrative Rule 660-033-130, parenthesis 38, which means lands that are cultivated or suitable for cultivation. I understand there's other pending legislation, I think 2820, I believe, that would change the definition to be a little more restrictive. However, in eastern Oregon, especially southeast Oregon, some rangeland is located on Class 4 soils. So it is important to keep the existing definition of arable land so that local government can interpret that accordingly, and therefore it's in the bill. Thank you for hearing me today. Umatilla County, of course, since we are pushing this forward, is wholly in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Who'd like to go next?
Mr. Seaman. Yeah. Again, members of the committee, Chairman Bailey, my name is Varner Seaman, Policy Director for Renewable Northwest Project. I'm going to refer to the highly technical picture I shared with you earlier.
Slow down there.
Sorry about that. This is an engineering degree I know for the cartoon. What we're talking about, again, is there's a fairly robust permitting process, which is clear for the siting of a renewable energy project. What became, thank you, Representative Burrow. thank you for sharing with the room. The question is how the permitting works for the generation timeline, that part that goes from the project to the transmission grid. And at first, I'll have to admit, Renewable Northwest Project wasn't excited about additional permitting obligations. We were somewhat reluctant to enter into this conversation. After Representative Smith encouraged us to be part of it, and after we heard the concerns from some of the folks who actually do the planning decisions and have to deal with the siting of these facilities and dealing with where a generation tie line is located, we realized there was a real issue here, and we wanted to work through a collaborative process. And again, we want to thank Representative Smith for running what we think was a very good work group process. essentially, the way we understand the bill, what it does is it says when you're permitting a gen tie line, again, from the project to the transmission line, you need to look first at can you put the gen tie line in an existing corridor? Can you avoid ag lands? Can you put it along an existing right-of-way, like, for instance, around a road? If you can do that, great, not a land use plan decision, it's a fairly straightforward decision. There's a second pathway which requires the project proponent to look at some alternatives or some other ways that they can avoid impacts on farmland, and if it's determined that they're going to have some impacts on farmland, they got to figure out how they're going to mitigate for that. We think, and that's as far as I can go in Oregon's land use planning system and still make sense. We think that this was a good process. We think that the amendments in 2704-1 are good policy. We agree with where the planners are at, and I think that this has been a pretty good work group process, and we think that this hopefully will move forward with some clarity for continuing to develop projects and also making sure that we're doing so in a way that respects farmland and doesn't have an adverse impact in terms of the arable lands for the state.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell, again here on behalf of Umatilla Electric Cooperative. I think most of what you need to hear has been said. We support the Dash 1 amendments. We're a customer-owned utility, and a large number of those customers are farmers. And so to maintain the integrity of exclusive farmland is critical for them, but as important is the ability for us to have predictability in decision-making and process, and the Dash 1 amendments provide that, and we support the Dash 1 amendments. And again, we'll like to thank the representative for putting together the work group and the work that work group did. I would like to say it was an exciting and engaging discussion, but it was dealing with land use, and so I cannot do so.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Whitsitt.
Under this bill, would any EFU land classification be considered arable?
The definition of arable, as I had referred to earlier, comes under, it would be the definition found in Administrative Rules 660, and historically land that was cultivated would be considered arable.
Okay, and my question is, would any EFU land fall under this classification, i.e. down to 3 and 4?
Representative Chair Bailey, I'm not sure. I cannot answer that for certain.
Mr. Chair, when the committee was convening, the definition of arable came up, and it was by my encouragement that we stayed away from doing any discussion on that definition because I wanted to keep the focus of this bill to the issue at hand.
Okay. One last question. Would you consider then that this bill gives the counties more or less say in the location of the lines, the gentile lines?
Mr. Chair, it depends. It depends. The first part is that it provides an incentive, and then should that incentive not be utilized, then it creates a process. And I don't know, Commissioner Givens, if you want to elaborate on that.
Chair Bailey, Representative, what's it? Yes, it would give the county more flexibility in determining, again, a two-step process. If it's located wholly on non-productive farmland, non-arable, not high-value farmland, then it would be a process that is administrative, not land use. However, under the criteria that would be given, it's listed in the bill, if they could not meet that criteria, then it would fall into the second, which would be a land use decision, what would be on high value or arable farmland.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious on line 18 on page 1, it says the entire route of the associated monument meets at least one of the following. Does that mean the entire line, or could it be segmented? There are, I think, four subparts, and it says the entire route meets at least one of the following requirements. So does that mean the entire route meets one,
it's
or could you have three
route.
Or four requirements in that route?
I believe it's the entire, not segments.
Do you want to answer that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, my understanding is that that's the entire route. As you're referencing, the section you're referencing there is sort of the first permitting option, which is the over-the-counter permitted set of criteria. So if the entirety of that line meets that permitted criteria, that's the option that you can use, which is, I think, as I've seen it from the project proponent standpoint, the easier route. If there is one segment of that that doesn't meet those criteria, you get kicked into the second process.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The idea is then the entire route would have to be either in A or in B or in C or in D. And if you weren't there, then you would fall into 4A, and that puts you back into the land use process and not just an administrative proceeding?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Do you have another thing to add?
Yes, Representative Chairman Bailey. I also serve on AOC's Energy Environment Committee, chair that. AOC did pass a resolution supporting this.
Thank you for that information. We appreciate it.
If I can just conclude with, there was a lot of work that went into this, and a lot of gratitude goes out to a lot of committee members. And I'm not going to mention them by name, but I'm going to look at y'all. Hours and hours and hours was spent on this, and Mr. Chair, we appreciate your consideration.
Appreciate your hard work on it. Thanks for bringing people together.
Two more folks signed up to testify. Call up Stephen Cafori and Todd Cornett, please.
We don't see Mr. Cafori. Cornett.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Cornett. I'm the Siting Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Energy. I was the Oregon Department of Energy's representative on Representative Smith's work group. First of all, I want to commend Representative Smith for having a very collaborative process. I thought it worked well. There was very diverse members, and we went along and all came to consensus. And so I just wanted to get up here and, on behalf of the Department of Energy, indicate our support of the Dash 1 amendments of this bill. And I would entertain any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you very much. Seeing no one else who wishes to testify, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2704. Open a work session. Let's start with opening a work session on House Bill 2203, the first bill we heard. Committee, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated April 4th, 2013.
Vice Chair Boone moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated April 4th, 2013. Is there discussion of the amendments? Seeing no discussion, is there objection to the amendments? Motion carries. Dash 3s are adopted. Vice Chair Boone.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2203 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 2203 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative
Dembrough. Aye.
Representative Drew.
Aye.
Representative Davis Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Weiser.
Aye.
Representative Whitson.
Aye. Vice Chair Johnson?
Excused.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Smith, you carry, please. Thank you. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2203. Open a work session on House Bill 2704.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments adopted April 4th, 2013.
Vice Chair Boone moves the Dash 1 amendments dated April 4th, 2013. Is there discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, is there objection to the amendment? Seeing none, motion carries. And, sorry, before your motion, I'll just make a quick explanation and say the original bill, 2704, had a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. With the amendment, we've been notified by LFO. There's no longer a fiscal on this bill. LFO has enough to do as it is, and they do not want to see this bill in Ways and Means. So we are planning to rescind that referral.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2704 as amended to the floor with the DPAS recommendation and request that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 2704 as amended to the floor with a DPAS recommendation and request that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to support the bill, but having been involved in these transmission siting processes and knowing just how incredibly challenging and difficult they are, and just how angry and upset folks get when they learn that a transmission line may pass either across or near their property, it's not without concern that I vote yes on this bill. And I've not spent the time necessary to go through it, nor have I contacted my county. I see that the one in which I live, in any event, Malheur County, I'm sure that they have done an adequate job in studying this. But I have learned through dint of sad experience that one does not lightly tread in this area. And so I will be voting yes today, but I will be getting on the telephone and calling my folks to make sure we're all on the same page.
Thank you, Representative. Mm-hmm. Representative Whitsitt.
Ditto.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate your succinctness. seeing no further discussion, please call the roll.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Dembrough?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Bank Fusion.
Aye.
Representative Wagner.
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt. Aye. Vice Chair Johnson.
Excused.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Bailey.
Aye. Motion carries. It's on its way to the floor. Representative Smith, will you carry this one too?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. We'll give you double duty. Thanks for your work on this. Close the public hearing on House Bill, or excuse me, close the work session on House Bill 2704. We go back up to the top, work through, open a work session on 2801. Colleagues, we have a Dash 6 amendment before us. We have our fiscal statement back with a minimal fiscal. Adam can explain the bill in some degree. Perfect timing, Vice Chair Johnson. The Dash 6 amendments are before you, and I just want to walk you through this briefly. I want to say thank you first to the large number of people that have worked very hard on getting this amendment together. As far as I know, there is no known opposition to this bill. I believe a consensus amendment. The Dash 6 is essentially accomplish three things. They set up standardization for who is allowed to do a home energy score assessment. Does not require them to, but standards for if they are done under, say, voluntary programs such as been set up by the Energy Trust of Oregon. It sets procedures and standards for who can do that work. Two, it sets up who's going to be in charge of, or at least a process for who's going to be in charge of how the scores are going to be essentially housed and where they're going to live. Three, it allows for permissively the Public Utility Commission to consider whole building cost effectiveness as opposed to just individual measures, and allows for packages of energy efficiency, and then it also asks for a process by which standardization of how real estate appraisal will take into account such scores and energy efficiency measures. There's been a fair amount of technical work on this bill. It is a voluntary bill that hopefully allows for more standardization within an emerging industry. Any comments on the dash sixes? Vice Chair Johnson.
Mr. Chair, is there anyone here from the department that might be able to discuss or speak to, I guess it's section 12 specifically, in terms of, as you were mentioning, where this information will live?
Right. We've got somebody coming up.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kill Harbick. I work for the Oregon Department of Energy. And I'm sorry, I couldn't hear your question before.
My question specifically is related to Section 12, and I guess primarily the sub 4 of Section 12, where it talks about the department may adopt right rural requirements, blah, 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 and then it gets into department shall keep and maintain a database of information reported to the department under the subsection. Can you just speak a little bit about what that might look like and what that data could be used for and who has access to it and so forth and so on?
Chair Bailey, Representative Johnson, the language in the bill essentially allows the department to set up this database and acquire data from the people that perform the assessments, get the scores. So we would basically store these scores and any associated information, how much energy the home uses, what sort of insulation levels are in the home, any associated data. And there's no language about making this data publicly accessible, so it would be a strictly internal set of data. And our intention, although it's not specified in the bill, would be to aggregate that data and report back to the legislature so that it may inform your future policy efforts.
So the information is purely for the discretion of the department to use as necessary. You're not selling that data to other people and
That's
so
correct.
Forth. You're not making it available as a matter of public information. But it is public information, is it not?
Chair Bailey, Representative Johnson, assuming that there's no confidential information collected, and I have no reason to believe there would be, that would be public information. So public records requests could come in that we would respond to.
Okay, thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Whitener.
Mr. Chair, I probably won't be supporting this bill today because right now you have the ability to go out and get a third-party auditor. I've had third-party audits done on my house or when you're buying a house. Part of the real estate process, you can get an appraisal. You can have an energy auditor come in and do an energy audit on the house. I think it's something that should be handled by the private sector, and I don't think it's anything that we need to deal with, so I will be a no vote on it today. So,
thank you.
If I may, Chair Bailey, Representative Weiner, this bill wouldn't restrict that practice from continuing. It simply sets a voluntary standard for the assessment, scoring, and certification.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In just a question following up on Vice Chair Johnson's remarks. The bill reads on page 18, in consultation with PUC, DOE shall adopt a rule for a performance score system. The question, I guess, would be how much time and effort is that going to take and what will be the foundation of that exercise? And is that, indeed, this bill appears to mandate that outcome. Am I reading the bill correctly?
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, essentially this effort would follow up on the work from 2009 SB 79 task force, which resulted in rules that essentially define a set of principles for a good energy performance score standard. This would build on that by looking at the various standards that are out there, applying those principles to those standards, and then through a public rulemaking process, identify which standard meets those criteria the best. The Public Utility Commission's role would be to be part of that process so that should any ratepayer concerns arise, they would be addressed.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
The process then anticipates that those who are interested in what standards a house should meet should appear at that rulemaking and weigh in on how much insulation, how thick the windows are going to be, what type of this, what type of that. In other words, there's a lot of variation in houses and in the types of materials that can be used in them. And I'm sure in that group that was put together 4 years ago, that came up and was addressed. Perhaps you can share with us the degree of variability that we might anticipate is going to come up in this discussion, because of course it will have a lot to do with how houses are going to be constructed, and because those standards are going to come into play, or am I missing the point?
Chair Bailey, Representative Bentz, you bring up some good points that various score systems that are out there weight differently these components that you mentioned, such as insulation. So one of the benefits of allowing that standard to be specified in rule is that as the industry evolves and as standards evolve, those rules can be amended to keep up with industry, as it were. So the participants that participate in the task force from SB 79 are, of course, welcome to participate in this new effort.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Woodson.
In Section 14, it says, Appraiser's Certification and Licensure Board will establish certification program for state licensed appraisers. What kind of cost do you think that's going to be to establish the certification program?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whipsett, I would have to refer you to the ACLB, as the Dash 6 amendments don't specify any role for ODA with that exception.
And Adam, just to check, we have a fiscal that has been submitted by the Board of Appraisers, and they have given it a minimal fiscal. Is that correct?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, that is correct.
They believe they can handle it under their existing programs.
Do we know where they are? Are they a yes on this?
They are not opposed to the bill.
So neutral, I guess, then?
Okay. I think that's a fair way to characterize it. Okay, seeing no further questions, thank you very much.
You.
Committee, given the time, it is my intention to move forward on this bill. Vice Chair Boone?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 6 amendments dated April 8th, 2013.
Vice Chair Boone moves to adopt the Dash 6 amendments dated April 8th, 2013. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the amendments? Seeing none, amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Boone?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2801 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 2801 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the incredible effort you put into this and others. I will be a no. The reason is this. The elements of a house, windows, roof, everything else, have their own measure of conservation merit. And when you put together in a house, you have such wide variation. The standards that need to be applied will, of necessity, be, I hate to say, incorrect, but it will be in only the unusual circumstance that they would fit. I understand how this would, the concept is a good one, putting a score on every house everywhere so people know what it is they're getting when they buy it. But this process is one that I'm not yet ready to support.
Thank you, Representative. I would emphasize for the record, this bill does not mandate any kind of program nor set up a program. It is simply for the voluntary programs that are out there setting some standards. Seeing no further discussion, clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Dembrough?
Yes.
Representative Reardon?
Yes.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Wagner?
No.
Representative Whitson?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
No.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries, and I will carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 2801. We have Representative Greenlick, who has joined us today, so I'm going to switch around a little bit to make sure he can come in and testify, and we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3492. Representative Greenlick, and while he's coming up, Adam, would you care to give us an explanation?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 3492 defines a major hazardous air pollution source, toxic air pollution, and toxic reduction plan. Adds toxic air pollutants released to the criteria of Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ, must consider when determining priority and providing technical assistance to toxics users and conditionally exempt generators. Creates requirements on toxics reduction plans for major HAP sources, including internal analysis and periodic assessment of individual processes, identification of opportunities to reduce or eliminate generation of toxic air pollutants, and employee awareness and training programs. Require toxics users that, if that is a major HAP source and that has previously developed a toxic reduction plan that does not address toxic air pollutants, to amend that plan within 120 days after notification by DEQ. Requires toxics users to notify DEQ when plan is in place.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, which includes the Northwest Industrial District of Portland. And my testimony is like he just said. I'm really happy to be here with this bill. I started the session with another bill intended to do something like this, and I think we talked about it here before. But the issue is that my district has some very significant problems with hazardous air pollution. The USA Today, in a study of elementary schools in the country, picked out Chapman Elementary School in my district as one of the 10 worst schools in the country for the environmental air hazards that surround this school. Heavy metals, particularly manganese, and a variety of other heavy metals pollute the environment, and the kids, my future constituents, spend their time at school in a relatively hazardous place. The Northwest Industrial District includes ESCO, a variety of other countries, some hydrocarbon farms, and it's a big problem to try and deal with the question of how do we reduce hazardous air pollution. We've had an air pollution solution group working in the Portland metropolitan area talking about air pollution and air quality. It's been getting not very much anywhere. This bill brings hazardous air pollution emissions into the context of other hazardous waste products and requires sources of potential hazardous air pollutants to create a plan for reducing those air pollutants over time and to do some other things like educating their employees to the issue. It seems like a reasonable time to begin to move this discussion to get DEQ in further contact and working closely with the major sources of hazardous air pollution. It's really time, it seems to me, for us to be dealing throughout the state with these issues in a serious way. I don't think anybody wants to live in an environment where the air is relatively hazardous. And what this bill will do is to begin the process for setting standards for sources of hazardous air pollution, as we do with other sources of other environmental hazards. Basically, I hope it's late in the session. I hope you'll have time to work this bill and think about it. Move it over to the Senate where we can think about it again and see if we can do something to help the problem.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for the Representative? Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm just curious.
No tough question.
No, the softball.
Oh, okay.
Nice. Get it out of the park. I'm just curious, though. You did reference that earlier in the session there was an additional or another bill that attempted to address the situation you allude to and so forth. But now, this late in the session, we have an entirely different bill that takes a different tact in terms of how it attempts to, let's say, mitigate or get at the problem. I'm just curious about what's transpired since the original bill was before this committee. We had a hearing, and this bill now, and why so late in the game, if you will.
Well, we live and learn. The original bill would deal in a very specific way. It would deal with it at the time of the permit for those industrial sources that require Title V permits. I think that number, if I remember correctly, was about 21 different Title V permitted sites. This one takes, rather than specifically dealing with it as a part of the permitting process, which is a little complex because of the relationship between the federal regulations and the state regulations and that titling, in that permitting process. This, I think, would hit about two-thirds of those same sources, but we do it in a much more general way over time without the pressure of worrying about holding up a permit or not holding up a permit. So it seems to me it's a sounder, more general approach to what we were trying to achieve in the first bill, and I was convinced that dealing with the permit was probably not the best way to deal with it.
See no further questions for you. Thank you, Representative. We appreciate you bringing this forward.
Thank you.
We'll let you get back to your other business.
Thank you very much. Thank you, members of the committee.
I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3492, open a work session on House Bill 2048. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee. The committee is being asked to consider the -4 amendments of House Bill 2048. The -4 amendments replace the measure. They provide definitions for permanent collection site, premium service and collecting, require stewardship organizations to provide retailers information on collection opportunities for customers, provides paint stewardship program, specifies paint stewardship program plan requirements, including education, outreach, and plan submittal deadlines, provides paint drop-off location standards, allows the director of the Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ, to require stewardship organizations to contract with local governments to provide collection sites for post-consumer paint, increases annual administration costs for stewardship organizations to $40,000, provides civil penalty caps for retailers and stewardship organization, extends paint stewardship pilot program sunset to June 30th, 2018, requires the director of the Department of Environmental Quality to submit a report to the Legislative Assembly describing the results of the pilot program no later than October 1st, 2016, declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
So essentially, committee, the -4 amendments that we have here address some of the issues that we heard before this committee. They address the issue of the sunset extension. It does not lift the sunset, as I think one of the previous bills that we saw did. It extends it out by 4 years. It achieves some of the transparency customer convenience provisions of the bill, and also has in it some pieces related to cost recovery for local haulers and counties. Is there anybody who would like to come up and speak to House Bill 2048-4 amendments? Everybody's very eager to do so. Okay. Questions from this committee about this discussion? Vice Chair Boone? Representative
Benz. I have some concerns about the -4s. I voted for this program, and I think this is a good program. There's three or four things in this -4 I do not like. I don't have a ready solution to the challenge that's faced with those that still are receiving paint and want to be reimbursed for it. I do know that that's not what I was thinking of as we put this into play when we voted for it previously. It seemed to me that the reduction in paint that this would achieve would more than offset the expense that landfills would be left with. So I am not happy with that because I think it may drive up the cost of those. All of our folks are now paying. I'm unhappy with three different things that are in the bill when it comes to the department. I'm unhappy with the additional fee because I didn't hear what that money would be spent for. And I do not like the penalties. This is not the kind of thing where you need a big stick. And one of the things that's been a great concern to me over the years I've been here is seeing DEQ have penalties in excess of need. I didn't hear any need for these penalties, and so I'll be a no.
Thank you. And this bill is on its way to Ways and Means next. I imagine there will be continued discussion. Representative Widener.
Mr. Chair, I'll be a no on this bill today as well. I think it will drive up the cost of paint for individuals, and I don't think it's going to help with people returning their containers or their unused paint. I don't think it's going to fix the problem. I think it's going to exacerbate the problem and make things much worse. So when we start doing this.
Vice Chair Boone?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -4 amendments dated April 11th, 2013.
Vice Chair Boone moves the -4 amendments dated April 11th, 2013. Is there discussion on the -4s? Representative Whitsitt?
I'm also opposed.
To the -4s?
To the -4s.
Okay, thank you. Clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Benz.
Aye. As to the dashboards.
To the dashboards.
Yeah, just to adopt the amendment.
Correct.
Oh, just to adopt.
Okay. Just to adopt the amendment.
Okay.
Representative Denbro.
Aye.
Representative Gruden.
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Wagner.
No.
Representative Whitsitt.
No.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries. Dash 4s are adopted. Now to the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2048 as amended to the floor with the DPAS recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 2048 as amended to the floor with a DPAS recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion. We may have had it. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Denbro?
Yes.
Representative Reardon?
Yes.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Wagner?
No.
Representative Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
No.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion passes, and bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 2048. Open a work session on House Bill 3103. Would the department like to come up and talk about 3103? Are they in the room?
Chair Bailey. Members of the committee, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the Government Relations Manager at the Department of Environmental Quality. I assume, Chair Bailey, you want me to talk about the Dash 3 on House Bill 3103? Okay. So on the Dash 3 on this bill, the Dash 3 amendment, simply allows the department to have the authority to address spill response where the export of petroleum products are going from shore to ship. There were, in the earlier versions of the bill and earlier amendments, there was language that would have allowed the department to deal with the same issue where liquefied natural gas was involved. That has been taken out of the bill. So we're simply left with the authority to try to require companies that are exporting petroleum products to manage for in the event that there are spills and then have the proper emergency response equipment staged and they had the proper training and preparations made for those kind of contingencies.
Thank you. And so to be clear, Mr. Mason, the Dash 3s address the concerns that we heard from both the petroleum industry and the natural gas industry. Is that correct?
That is correct, Chair Bailey.
Committee, what's your pleasure? Mr. Boone?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated April 1, 2013.
Vice Chair Boone moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated April 1, 2013. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the amendments? Amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3103 as amended to the floor with a DPAS recommendation.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 3103 as amended to the floor with a DPAS recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Denbro?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Wagner?
No.
Representative Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion passes. Representative Whitsitt, would you carry, please?
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt will carry. And close the work session on House Bill 3103. I said it before, but I'll say it again. House Bills 2005 and 3030 are being carried over. So we are going to return to our public hearing on House Bill 3492. And I'd like to call up Mary Pivido and John Coleman, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Mary Pivoteau. I am representing Neighbors for Clean Air. Thank you, Chair Bailey, and all the committee members for this opportunity to speak in support of HB 3492. This bill would expand the existing toxic use reduction program to include air emissions. I've had the honor to testify before you, indeed, just about a month ago. And what I'd like to speak to today is to underscore the need for our state to address a real risk to the citizens of Oregon and why I believe HB 3492 is a step in that direction. You know, we have a lot of information about the risk of air pollution in our state. In fact, it's the residual risk that's left behind after 40 years of the Clean Air Act. Oregon, no county in Oregon was below the unreasonable risk value of 1 in a million that the EPA states. And in fact, Oregon has the third largest population in the United States at risk of excess cancer due to toxic air emissions. Approximately 3.2 million Oregonians live in counties with risk values twice that standard. And the problem's even worse in urban areas, Lane, Marion, Jackson, Clackamas, Multnomah County, and Washington counties, where approximately 2.2 million Oregonians have an average cancer risk value four times the standard. I'd like to take a moment before I get into the rest of my testimony on a day that is, I want to talk about when we talk about one excess cancer as an acceptable risk, because I'd like to ask who is that reasonable and acceptable risk of one excess cancer? In our community, I've known too many friends and neighbors who have dealt with cancer over the last few years. But last year, we lost one person. Now, the EPA puts a value on one person's life lost at $8 million. But what do you put the value on a man who was a fifth grade teacher, one of the most outstanding teachers at Chapman Elementary School? He's the father of two young children who 5 and 7 years old at his passing. What value do you put on a person's life? And I guess I just want you to remember that when we're talking about hazardous air pollutants and we're talking about excess and EPA standards, we're talking about people's lives, and real people's lives are affected by this every day. Neighbors for Clean Air was founded by myself and my neighbors because we discovered our school was in the bottom 2% in the nation because of proximity to industrial air pollution alone. We soon learned that this was not a problem of one neighborhood and one polluter, but that no school in Portland ranked better than the bottom 30% in the nation. And that, in fact, 116 schools in Oregon are ranked in the bottom 10% in the nation, looking at only industrial air pollution. From that same study of pollution in schools, we learned that the facilities designated as Title V sources, especially those that emit the highest volumes of hazardous air pollutants, like those which would be subject to this new program, were significant contributors to the toxic problem of the worst-ranking schools. That is, that Title V schools were significant contributors to toxic pollution at 96 of those 116 schools, and that Title V sources were the most significant contributor at 37 of those schools. When I began to unpack the problem of risk of toxic air emissions, I was amazed at how little we know. And in fact, how often concerns from communities were shuttled with the response that industry is not a significant contributor to air pollution in our state, and it's estimated to just be 10% of the total. We soon learned that that was a statewide pie, and it was nearly impossible to assess the actual emissions from individual facilities, to know what the facility could change to make improvements, and more alarming, what effect these toxic emissions have on our children. Subsequent analysis of available data says that if you live close to a large source of industrial emissions anywhere in Oregon, like I do, it can be as much as 50% of the toxic problem in your air. We need common sense approaches to address these real risks to public health. And I believe that HB 3492 will give us the important building blocks to reduce unnecessary industrial air toxics in our neighborhoods. And I urge you to consider this very carefully and for your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Coleman.
Good afternoon. My name is John Crawlman. I am the staff attorney for Neighbors for Clean Air. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify in support of House Bill 3492. I do want to give a brief overview of what this bill does and then open it up for questions. This bill requires only those sources that are major sources of hazardous air pollutants. I believe there are 65 of these sources in Oregon. All of them are Title V sources, so all of them would have been covered under Representative Greenlink's original Bill 2336. It requires these sources to either create or amend a plan that would specifically look at ways that they could reduce their inputs of toxic chemicals in order to reduce the outputs of toxic air chemicals. So it looks at what has them look at what their inputs are in order to assess ways that they could reduce toxic outputs. There is a very, very similar program at the federal level, the Pollution Prevention Program. As an environmental consultant, I worked on several of those at military installations. The federal government requires these installations every 5 years to revise these plans. They are not that difficult to do. You look at what's on the shelf right now, what's technically feasible, what's economically feasible, and you put it in a plan. And then the source has the option to look at that down the road and start developing ways and mechanisms to implement that. The important thing about this bill is that those options, whether they be economically feasible, technically feasible, or economically infeasible, technically infeasible, what the barriers are to those, what the source has already done, gets shared with DEQ. So DEQ gets more information on how to address or how DEQ might be able to address toxic air pollution. This is an important step because there are many different emission points of toxic air pollution, such as area sources, non-road sources, road sources. But the solution to those tend to be fairly straightforward. You make your car more efficient. You change out your diesel engines and construction vehicles. You have homeowners have to change out wood stoves. In the industrial scope, though, that's not the case. Each industry tends to be unique, and so there's no clear-cut solution to reducing toxics. This bill is a first step at trying to assess what DEQ can do to reduce those toxic emissions. I'll open it up for questions if there are any from the committee.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
Thank you. Remember the original bill and stuff that we met and talked on and all the testimony that happened. I remember ESCO was brought up several times, and you mentioned him several times today. Have you ever tried entering into an agreement with them or working with them on any of the issues? Has anything happened there?
Thank you, Chair Bailey and Representative Widener. Yes. In fact, we actually ended up negotiating a good neighbor agreement with ESCO Steel to reduce emissions.
And I would say, actually, that ESCO would not actually be covered by this bill. While it is a large source of hazardous air pollutants in that neighborhood, it isn't actually a major source. It doesn't emit more than 10 tons of one pollutant or 25 tons of total hazardous pollutants. So it wouldn't actually even be covered by this bill. We're looking at only the largest of the large emitters of toxic pollution.
I may follow up. Because we're talking the industry and you have an agreement with ESCO, it sounds like they're working well with you. So which company is it you're really going after down there in the industrial area?
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener.
It's actually Widener.
Widener, excuse me. We're not going after anyone. We're going after pollutants that exist in our air that are documented by DEQ's emissions data and reports. We have, you know, oftentimes it's very difficult for individuals and communities to assess the sources of these toxic pollutants that are in the air and in their neighborhoods. What we're looking for then is a common sense mechanism for reductions where communities aren't left with the burden to try and identify and single out sources or the root cause of the problems. I think it's really, honestly, beyond the scope of most communities' resources.
Yes, I may follow up. Yes, I'm just kind of curious because it sounds like ESCO was a very good company to work with, and entered into a good neighbor agreement. Have you tried approaching the other businesses to do the same with them, and has anybody shut you out? Or, because I'm just trying to get a grasp, because that industrial area has been there forever. So, and I'm sure you bought your home after the industrial environment was there. And I mean, one of the things strategies you need to look at is, do we want to move schools, things like that in the area? I'm just wondering, businesses are probably pretty friendly on helping mitigate a lot of these issues, and I'm trying to get it. Have you been reaching out to them, is my key point.
Chair Bailey, Representative Wider. Yes, we attempt as much as we can to have discourse and conversation. It is, again, very difficult to identify all the sources, we had some particularly unique tools at hand to help identify the risk of the ESCO emissions in the Northwest neighborhood that aren't afforded to all communities in order to identify which are the likely sources. And so, again, I think that this onus and the responsibility for the communities to identify is what then will be necessary in order to have active engagement, and that is usually very much out of reach of most communities to be able to do on their own. So we would be very interested. I did participate as a member of the Portland Air Toxic Solutions Advisory Committee, which was another opportunity for all stakeholders to engage. And unfortunately, industry did not want to participate in our smaller group discussions about, you know, what we could do. So we haven't found we found individual businesses that are very friendly and interested. We haven't found as a sector that they are interested in having discussion to find some more systemic solutions.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry.
The challenge, I suppose, is that we have a set of standards in place that these organizations must meet under their permitting process. And what is being suggested here is an additional amount of work over and above the standards already in these otherwise widely accepted and understood baseline efforts that these companies must make.
So,
Ms. Nischet, please. I've noticed we here in Oregon justifiably are proud of that which we do to protect our environment. The net result, though, is for much of that which we used to do here to be exported to places like China, which I had the opportunity to visit a year or so ago. And then we let them engage in these unfortunate practices, and then we buy their stuff down at Walmart. The effort that you are making, which I can understand, is to add to that motivation to leave and export the bad things we do to other places that aren't as capable, shall we say, or as fortunate to be able to engage what we're doing today. My question to you isn't so much, will this drive industry away? My question is, how can we assure businesses that come to Oregon that we won't do exactly what you're suggesting we do and add to the burden they're already carrying by virtue of this nationwide set of standards? What is the message that we're sending to those that want to come to this state and set up shop?
Chair Bailey and Representative Benz, I appreciate the points that you're making. One of the problems really is not necessarily the rules of new businesses, since new businesses are actually subject to a whole different set of regulations. And these are really only rules, and most of our Title V, if not all of them, and I defer to John, are existing and long existing facilities. ESCO, for example, dates to 1913. My house dates to 1904. So there's been a long-standing relationship between residents and in industry in our city, and long-standing. And most of this issue, in 1970s with the Clean Air Act and even with the amendments, there was a bargain made about grandfathering in the oldest and dirtiest polluters. There have been 12 states, and Oregon is one of them, that have attempted to address the residual risk, which is sort of the promise of the 1990 amendments of the Clean Air Act, to address, we set technology standards, but then we need to go back and do step two, which is address the residual risk. What's left over? Is there still a risk of toxic air pollution? We know that 50% of the population of America lives in airsheds that is harmful to health, and we know that this problem is not unique to Portland, Oregon, but it's no better in Portland, Oregon, which I think surprises a lot of my neighbors and my friends. We know that there is so much more that can be done. We've been through this. I can't speak for all industry in terms of their own analysis of what constitutes a viable business. I can speak for ESCO Steel that they were able to make significant investments. They will get, you know, significant gain from the community standpoint with a 20% reduction in emissions, and they seem that is a viable cost of business for them, and it is, you know, they're able to continue on and do the job that they need to do to continue working at the facility.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
And Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that we have in our toolbox, so to speak, for the state is the Oregon Solutions program, and I thought that this was going to have one of those projects starting maybe at the end of our session. And I just wondered what happened to that and why, if you know, and why you wouldn't want to go that route, because that usually entails all the stakeholders taking part and literally signing a contract to agree on something in the end if they can. I've been a co-convener on two of them and a member of a third, and they're very successful, and sometimes people are very surprised that they can come to consensus on an issue as difficult as this one might be.
Thank you, Chair Bailey and Vice Chair Boone. I appreciate that, and I very much appreciate the work of Speaker Kotek, actually, to reach out and try and get that resource for the community. And I think that it's a really interesting prospect. You know, right now, the Oregon Solutions, I will say that the Portland Air Toxic Solutions Advisory Committee process was run as an Oregon Solutions. And I think that the mandate for stakeholder, voluntary, and unanimous consensus were really ultimately a big part of the reason why there were no recommendations for reductions that came out of the Portland Air Toxic Solutions. So from a very personal standpoint, I can compare the same 2.5 years of my life that I spent serving on that committee with 2.5 years of direct negotiation to actually reduce emissions from ESCO Steel, where we got a 20% reduction. And so it's difficult for me to see that without some impetus for industry to engage in this process in good faith, that we're going to get much from it. So I'm still waiting. I think it's we are exploring that. And as I said, I think in that unique situation of the one neighborhood and the industry that's impacting it, it probably will be a very good process. Thank you for the question.
If I may add on, Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Boone, part of the problem is that to get a group together and start talking, you need to know what you're talking about. And at the moment, the community simply has no idea of if we're talking at the table with industry, we have no idea what the solutions are out there. We say we need you to reduce emissions, and they say we can't. We've got to just take their word for it. The idea behind this bill, and while it isn't a public access bill, it does give DEQ, who's at the table, can ground truth those things. And so the idea behind this bill is to let's all get on the same page as far as what industry can do, so that when we come to the table, and this is what happened at ESCO, ESCO did a much more complete audit, and so we were all working from the same script and could actually then really openly communicate. And at the present time, we really just don't have that information to be able to sit down at a table with even a specific industry and talk to them in that kind of process. And so this is trying to get us to the point where we can do that.
Representative Denbrough.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say I appreciate the strategy that's being used here, moving away from the permitting process. You know, we heard a lot of testimony about problems with using that route to deal with this problem. And, you know, building off of the existing framework that the state has with respect to toxics and hazardous waste, I mean, essentially all that this bill is doing, well, it's doing more, but I mean, essentially what it's doing is it's saying that air quality, air toxics are a matter of concern in the same way that other toxics are. And that seems not that big a stretch for me personally. And it seems like air quality is something that we should be concerned with. And so piggybacking off of the existing process that exists for hazardous waste and toxic, I think was a very intelligent decision.
Thank you, Representative. Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pavito, in your testimony, as you were listing or describing, I guess, the toxic environment that you find or that you sense in Portland Metro and so forth, I've got to admit them. It's hard for me to believe that we're talking about the same environment. As we talk about air pollution, lack of air quality and stuff, I've been to China, and I know what it's like to, at certain times of the day, literally be not able to see across the street because the air is so thick with pollutants. I've been to Guatemala City, I've been to Mexico City, and I know what those residents there live with, and yes, that is polluted air, but as we move to Oregon, and anywhere in the States, for instance, does not compare to what you see in other countries and so forth. And I'm not saying that's okay, but what I'm saying is that we do have state agencies whose, i.e. DEQ, whose job it is to monitor the air, the water, land use, that sort of thing, to ensure the safety of the residents of this state. So my question, I guess, is why is DEQ not bringing this bill to us, saying that we've got a public health crisis in Portland and we need greater statutory authority to deal with it? Why is DEQ not involved in bringing this bill to us?
And before you answer that, I might say it's probably not within this panel's purview to speak for the department. So I'm going to let you off the hook on that one and take that as a rhetorical question.
Can I say one thing
please.
To that, though? That the data that I have is from DEQ in terms of the Portland air toxics, the problem of Portland air toxics. So their emissions data on, you know, 17 pollutants and the risk of excess cancers and others is from the state DEQ's data.
And I would simply add a comment as well. As somebody who was born and raised in Southeast Portland, I like to hope that we hold the environmental quality in my home community to a little bit higher standard than a third world country. Representative Whitson.
Yes, maybe I missed this. Does this bill create exceedance of Clean Air Act standards?
I didn't hear what she said.
Chair Bailey.
Representative Whitson, would you care to repeat the question?
Yes, does this bill create exceedance of the Clean Air Act standards?
Representative Bailey, Representative Whitson. That answer is yes, but not from a it doesn't set a higher standard for industry. What it does is it adds an additional analysis that industry is required to do. So in that essence, it does go above what the Clean Air Act requires, but it's not the same as what the Clean Air Act is. It's not specifically aimed at, it's not, you couldn't look at the Federal Clean Air Act and find a program anywhere close to this, because it's sort of a, you would have to look outside of the Clean Air Act to things like the Federal Pollution Prevention Program, which applies to federal agencies and requires them to do an analysis of pollution prevention mechanisms. You can look to other states. For instance, I know Massachusetts has a program very similar to the one that we're proposing here, which is an expansion of Oregon's current program that includes both air toxics and hazardous waste reduction. So it's a little hard to succinctly answer yes or no to that question.
Can I follow up?
Quick follow-up.
you say the Clean Air Act standard is the standard that the EPA sets for the United States?
Chair Bailey, Representative Winsett, yes, the Federal Clean Air Act standards are set by EPA.
And last question, are there any other states whose statutes for air quality exceed the EPA's Clean Air Act air quality standards?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, there are at least 12 that exceed it specifically for toxic air pollution. If we're talking about this kind of review of pollution prevention programs, I know that there are many, many states that have these same type of programs. I mentioned Massachusetts because I've looked into their program before. Outside of the toxics and this specific context, it varies state to state, and I couldn't give you a full number of the number of states that have programs that exceed what the federal standards are.
Thank you. Thank you to this panel. Very quickly, Representative.
Well, I just had a question. Nobody has really talked about the amount of work and what it might cost and to do this additional work and who would pay for that. So that's my, I think that can often be a bone of contention. I was just wondering if you had thoughts on that.
Chair Bailey, Representative Reardon. My understanding is that of the 65 sources that would be impacted by this this new program on air toxics, 60 of them are already required to do the same analysis for hazardous waste and for water waste. And so the difference between what they're doing now and what they'd be required to do is it's there, but it's not that significant. I can't speak to how Oregon implements this program because these are not public records, so I have never looked at one of these. I have done them at federal facilities. I was part of a pollution prevention plan development team at Quantico Marine Corps Base, which is the size of a county. So it has hundreds of different things to look at. And honestly, that was not the most complex thing we did. The total report was maybe 40 pages long. So I don't think that this is that expensive of a requirement.
Thank you. Sufficient?
I will keep asking the question of others.
Please. Thank you. Thank you to this panel. We appreciate your time. As I call up the next panel committee, I want to say that we're going to go a little bit over today. I want to get as much testimony as possible in on the next bill. However, we will not get all of the testimony in on the next bill, and we will have to carry over the remainder of the testimony to the next day. So for those of you on the on the next bill who are considering whether or not you can come back on Tuesday, please send a note up to the dais if you absolutely cannot come back on Tuesday to finish the testimony on the next bill. And with that, call up John Ledger, Tom Wood, Lori Luchek, and Mike Sullivan, please.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
By the next bill, you mean the next bill you're referring to?
Is 2807.
Sorry, is 2807.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries, and in the interest of time, I'm representing several other groups: Oregon Metals Industry Council, Northwest Pulp and Paper Association, Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association, Oregon Forest Products Industries Council, and American Forest and Paper Association. This bill is actually quite similar to the one you saw in the first place in function. It does move it out of the permitting statutes, but it puts it in an unusual statute that was passed in 1989, I believe, to reduce, primarily one of the functions was to reduce the amount of hazardous waste that was getting trucked to federally approved disposal sites around the state. At the time, there was a lot of concern about having enough room to dispose of all the hazardous waste. And it's quite different than dealing with air emissions and Title V issues. But the function is about the same, I think. The scope is quite different. It does take a subset of the Title V group, and you'll be getting passed out the facilities that are covered by it. Interestingly, most of what you have heard, and this has been going on for actually many years, as Ms. Pivato alluded to, we are all on work groups that have been going on for a long time. focusing on the industrial area in Portland. The bill, of course, applies statewide and applies to many types of facilities that really I don't know if it's appropriate at all. We thought actually that this was pretty much solved, or at least there was some resolution, and that there are going to be some things that I think we're going to look at addressing what the issues were in the community. One was the DEQ is gearing up to do a pretty comprehensive redo and strengthening of what it refers to as its nuisance program to address odors, which certainly has been an issue in that area. And also there is the Oregon Consensus Program that just frankly seems to be made for something like this. And it deals with often contentious issues, some cases where standards apply, some cases where they don't. And it's run out of Portland State University, and I think it's been very successful. And I think this would be, a perfect candidate for that type of program. You're getting some other materials. There was a lot of talk about risk. Residual risk is a requirement of the Clean Air Act, and that runs through after they achieve, they go through the maximum achievable control technologies. As you'll remember, we also have had a comprehensive statewide toxics assessment, including a Portland toxic study. And the DEQ has a comprehensive approach to it, and which is they look at the top issues first, and they also look at the focus local issues. And the DEQ has very extensive toxics regulations, unusual for states, most states don't. And it addresses issues individually, addresses them as a community, and there's even kind of a catch-all at the end, a safety net, where if there is a problem and no rules whatsoever apply, it just falls through for some reason, the agency can address that too on a source-specific basis. The Environmental Quality Commission has heard all these concerns. They've dealt with them. They've blessed the statewide comprehensive toxics policy. They've dealt with this a lot. And they just haven't used this approach, even though it's been presented to them. They prefer something that's more comprehensive. I'm going to ask, Tom Wood is here, who is our co-chair, AOI co-chair of our air committee, and with Stoll Reeves, and also Lori Luchek, who is president of Miles Fiberglass, and I'd like to turn it over to Tom, if I could.
Okay. Thank you, John. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Tom Wood. I'm a partner at the Stoll Reeves Law Firm. I'm a professor, adjunct professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, where I lecture on the Clean Air Act, and I'm also, as John said, chair of the AOI Air and Energy Committee. House Bill 3492 recasts the old 2336 just into a different program. It's the same burdens, and it's an really extensive burden. Representative Reardon asked in terms of cost. Our estimation is for a small facility. This is a $15,000 to $25,000 cost per facility. That's for a small facility. And you look over the list, and you've been given a list of the different facilities that would be captured by this. You'll see over half of them are wood products facilities. These are facilities that are on this list because they dry sap out of trees. And the sap includes wood alcohol. That's why it's called that. And wood alcohol is a hazardous air pollutant. So as a result of drying the sap out of trees, these folks are going to have to go through that sort of an investment. And that is a really significant cost right now. I work with a lot of small wood products facilities, and that's an employee. You know, they have to lay somebody off so they can afford to do that. You'll also see that among the sources there, they are listed as major hazardous air pollutant sources. That does not mean they actually emit much in the way of hazardous air pollutants. One of the odd ways in which they're classified is that you are classified based on what your paper capability was of emitting, not what you actually emitted, but what your paper capability was when the first standard came out that applied to you. So you may emit nothing. You may be doing something entirely different on your facility today, and you are still considered a major source of hazardous air pollutants. So this is just a poorly focused effort. The work is significant, and if we're going to put that sort of burden on sources, we ought to know who it is that we're really targeting. And Mr. Krallman testified before me something I think that's important. He said he'd never seen one of these plans. And I think that's important because, again, to understand this program, the Toxic Use Reduction Program is an internal assessment. to the extent that they're saying we want this program so that we can now learn all these things about facilities, this was agreed very early on in the toxic use reduction program that this was confidential business information, and it's not available to the public. You provide a notice to DEQ, you don't provide the plan to DEQ. So I, for all these reasons, I urge you to object to this bill. It is not focused on the right sort of sources. As was talked about before, Portland Air Toxic Solutions, DEQ looked at what the key sources were that were causing toxic air pollutants, and far above industrial sources was lawn care. It was residential wood combustion. It was diesel engines. It was all these other categories. And we're down at number 9 in terms of the point sources of industrial air pollution. So we feel like it's appropriate to focus efforts where the effort is needed, and this bill doesn't accomplish that. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Thompson, Vice Chair Boone, and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Lori Luchek, and I'm president of Miles Fiberglass and Composites. We manufacture wind turbine parts, electric vehicle component parts, light rail train components, and refrigerated rail car parts. We are a family-owned business, and we have 50 employees. We have a hazardous waste permit. We are trying to get out of that permit currently because we recycle 100% of our hazardous waste. Currently, we do file our annual DEQ reports, pay our fees, and update our hazardous waste reduction plan, and hopefully we'll be out of that program. We also have a Title V permit. Our emissions are limited by our permit. Currently, it is not included in the hazardous waste reduction plan. However, over the last 8 years, we have reduced our air emissions by 50%. In 2005, our sales were $4.3 million, and in 2012, our sales were $9 million, but we held our emissions to the same as 2005. That's a 50% reduction. Not all HAPs are cancer-causing. All show up on the list, may not be major emitters as well. And the reason for this is you need to file your potential to emit, and that's if you were running 24/7. Our actuals are actually 1/4 of what we are permitted to file or to admit. The main reason we have reduced our emissions isn't because we were required to do so. We reduced our emissions for the following reasons. It is the right thing to do. We care as much about the environment and our employees as anybody. Most of the products we make are parts for energy efficiency and sustainable products. Whenever possible, we look at reducing our emissions and our waste. We work close with our association, who continually introduces us to new materials, processes, and equipment to help us reduce our emissions and use material more efficiently. We now use a low styrene resin, a non-atomized chop gun, employee training, and a filled resin system, all adding to reducing our emissions. We pay our annual emissions and hazardous waste amounts annually. Anytime we can reduce that amount, we save dollars, not only on the annual permit fees, but also on the savings of reducing our materials. We don't need another regulation that does very little but adds paperwork to the already mounds of paperwork required. In the end, all it would accomplish is adding more employees to DEQ to monitor the paperwork, adds to the already growing state deficit, and takes time away from business to focus on growing their business and adding jobs.
Your comments, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm done.
You good? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Sullivan.
Yes. Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Boone, and Johnson, the committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the Oregon Political Director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, commonly and thank God known as AWPPW. AWPPW is opposed to House Bill 3492 in the simple reason that we see this as a job killer. There are two things that kill industrial jobs in Oregon. It is the extreme environmental concerns that citizens have. The number one issue, and it's national, are trade agreements. And if we're looking for a bully on the block internationally, it has to be China. China's mercury emissions into the air are recorded, as far as I know, back to at least 2005. And it's daily coming here, and it's airborne, and it comes right to us, to our shore. that I know of, all of the plants that AWPPW has workers in, the Title V compliances are in there. And the idea of odor, obviously, paper workers are very, you know, keen on the idea the odors are bad. And right now, there doesn't seem to be an odor problem. There are monitoring systems in each site for odors. And I'll offer one example of the local union in Toledo. With their employer, they have an environmental group that interfaces with the community twice a year, as Representative Boone was talking about. We think this is an approach that should be done. This is an issue that is germane to one area, in Portland, Oregon, I should say. It's not the entire state. I really don't think anyone in this room, including myself, really wants to see any job leave Oregon. We would ask this committee to vote no and go with consideration of community-based problem solving. And I will answer any questions that I can. And I would like to point out that my handout is not germane to this bill, but it's what I answered that was in the paper about passing effective legislation quickly and my rebuttal on we need industrial jobs. And I'll answer any questions if there are any. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Reardon.
I'm just concerned about the impact, Lori, on your company because I'm most familiar with it. Small company. You're obviously away from the desk today. What do you see as a financial cost of additional reporting?
Probably for us, probably somewhere between if we hired somebody to help us, which you know, it depends on how complex it is, probably around $10,000 a year.
Or
it would be less in the years after that, but to put the plan together first, and then it would cost more than the annual update.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Seeing no one else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3492, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3492. I'm going to carry over the work session on House Bill 3492. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2807. We have a lot of folks signed up on this that we're not going to get to, and I apologize. But I do want to get through two panels. So we're going to call up, start with Marion Haynes and Scott Bolton.
What's that? 2807. Oh, yeah, that's true.
Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes. I represent Portland General Electric. We represent approximately 825,000 customers, primarily in the northern Willamette Valley. We're here speaking to you today about this bill. It will eventually, I believe, be a gut and stuff to address the energy supplier assessment. The energy supplier assessment is an unusual assessment that is placed on all energy providers in the state based on their gross revenues. It's unusual in that it is delegated to the director of the agency, and the way that it works essentially is once a budget expenditure is adopted by the legislature, other fees that are brought in by the agency, federal funds, other funds are brought together, and then any gap between those dollars and the expenditure limitation is assessed on energy providers throughout the state. It's on electricity providers, natural gas, propane, wind, all energy providers in the state. The ESA dollars for the agency are what provide the bulk of the fungible dollars. Our interest in the ESA is not about the actual amount of the dollars. We understand that it's important for the agency and the operations of the agency, and we appreciate and rely on many of the programs of the Department of Energy. particularly FSEC is one that we are very concerned about. We have a number of projects right now before FSEC, and so ensuring that the Department of Energy is a highly functioning and resourced agency is important to PGE. So it's not the existence of the dollars that is the issue. Our goal in looking at potential changes to the energy supplier assessment is really about bringing more transparency and accountability to those dollars, which ultimately flow through to our customers. And so that's really the interest there. We're focused on the ESA because there have been some frictions with this agency in the past. I particularly want to know for the record that we're very pleased to have the new director at the department. Director Schwartz has been doing a very nice job, and we would like to commend her on many of the changes that she has adopted within that agency, and we do recognize that there have been significant improvements. That being said, these are dollars that can be used for almost anything. In the past, they have been used to create barriers and obstacles in trying to meet RPS compliance and things of that nature. In the past, it no longer happens right now, but dollars raised through the energy supplier assessment have also used to fund positions in entirely different agencies, like the Department of Agriculture. And those are the kinds of things that we've had problems with in the past. We're hoping that through this process, and want to thank Chair Bailey for the work that he's done to step in and create a place to have a conversation about what we can do to ensure this greater in transparency and accountability that we're looking for going forward. And I guess there's four main areas that we have an interest in pursuing whether we can get some changes that we can find some agreement on. One is the use of ESA dollars for funding the agency to intervene in regulatory proceedings, particularly before the PUC, but other agencies as well. The PUC is where we're focused because that's our economic regulator. Decisions made by the PUC impact our ability to run our business, and so that's of particularly keen interest to us, and we'd be looking for some ways to have better insights over how and when the department may be able to participate in those types of proceedings. Number two, we'd be looking at some sidebars or some way to ensure that the dollars raised by the ESA are used really to fund the statutory obligations of the agency. So we don't see things like, as I mentioned before, funding a position in the Department of Ag and things of that nature. There have been other attempts, even within the past few years, to raise ESA dollars to fund things like Oregon Inc. And those are the types of things that we want to try to avoid going forward. Number three, we'd like to see some additional transparency in the process. We'd like to be able to understand at a program level how much ESA dollars are going to implementing particular programs and have that information be available earlier in the legislative process so that as budgets are going through Ways and Means, we can really have a conversation about how much money is being used to fund specific programs and whether that's correct and to be able to have that conversation in the legislative context. And finally, there is the notion of an advisory committee. If the department wants a sounding board made up of all the stakeholders of the agency, that's fine. I think that's their prerogative, but it doesn't substitute for really meeting with those funding the agency and having that open process about where the dollars go, how much is going to be raised prior to entering the legislative session and the budget discussions that go on. So those are the areas where we're focused and a little bit of the background on why we're interested in this issue. Again, I'd like to reiterate that it's really about transparency and accountability. We understand that the funds are needed by the department. We want to see the department functioning well and have a very keen interest in that and making sure that we all understand the process and the dollars and how they're used, I think will help solidify that even more going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bolton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. We serve 560,000 customers across communities all across the state as Pacific Power. I know the hour's late, so I'll try not to cover a lot of the same ground Ms. Haynes just covered. But, you know, as she described, the energy supplier assessment is assessed on most of the electrons and BTUs sold in Oregon. It captures the revenues of electric companies, gas companies, wind and solar producers, some transportation fuels, and even propane. These dollars go to generally fund the department, but as Ms. Haynes also identified, these funds can also be captured and used outside of the department, and that has become a growing problem. While Pacific Power has paid its fair share of the ESA for years, recent difficulties with the department caused our management and legal team to more closely examine the ESA, how it is raised and how it is used. As we delved into this, into the ESA, it became clear, to us at least, that the ESA is not a traditional regulatory fee, but rather is a privilege tax assessed on Oregon's energy industry. As such, we believe it's been illegally raised, and Pacific Corp and Cascade Natural Gas have brought a complaint before Marion County Circuit Court challenging the constitutionality of the ESA. While we do feel strongly that the ESA is currently constructed is legally deficient, we do recognize that the department should be adequately funded, and our intent is not to defund the agency. But the ESA gives rise to questions of what is the appropriate nexus between how an agency raises funds and how it spends funds. What is the appropriate relationship between the agency and those who pay for it? Can the legislature, frankly, create a more accountable, transparent, and durable system for the department? We believe House Bill 2807 is an important step towards answering those questions. Our hope is to bring new process and transparency to how the ESA is raised. We'd like to see more stakeholder engagement and, frankly, legislative oversight. Rather than the ESA being used as base budgeting, this bill hopefully will allow stakeholders and policymakers better insight into the activities and how the dollars are raised and what they go towards, and in turn help set the appropriate amount and priority for those dollars. Like PGE, we also believe that a fundamental issue around the ESA is whether it should be used to fund the department's intervention in the regulatory proceedings of other agencies. I mean, we believe that as currently constructed, dollars raised from the energy industry should not be used to fund intervention by a department that is taking an adverse position to the industry that it gets its funding from. And I want to be really clear on the notion of intervention, because what we're not talking about here is proposing to ban the department from sharing its expertise with other state agencies or stakeholders. We're not looking to prevent the agency from performing its statutory duties. Whether in the PUC or at the Department of Environmental Quality or other state agencies that have a regulatory function, when the department weighs in and weighs in a proceeding that is creating a record that ultimately a decision will be based on that governs our company or our industry or our activities, it does so with a different weight than other parties. It is the state of Oregon. If intervention, frankly, is in the public interest, and it's the public interest opinion that's being expressed through that intervention, it would be more appropriate to fund that intervention through the general fund coming from all Oregonians in order to benefit all Oregonians. But right now we have a fairly unsustainable situation where there's great aggravation between the ESA payers and how those dollars are being used in some circumstances that don't seem to align with the interests of those payers. We're seeking a reasonable set of reforms that would put the agency on a more durable footing with its funders and stakeholders. As Marion said, and you'll probably hear more and more, it really is about transparency and accountability. We really just want good government and fairness out of this, and I hope that as this bill develops that we can find a place where we can all support it. Thank you. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bolton. Questions for this panel? Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Scott, can you talk more about the legal proceedings you guys are involved in and what you might hope to come from that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson,
I'm just going
to a degree.
Yeah, in a frame that we're
crafting public policy here, and I think we feel free to talk about what makes good public policy. Essentially, the complaint is, frankly, just over the constitutionality of whether this is a tax or a fee. It's a fee in name. Our concern, our allegation, is that as it's constructed and used, it resembles much more closely a tax, and as such, hasn't been constitutionally raised.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, I know you've spent your time testifying to what should fall within the ESA, but the most succinct statement of what should be in it as far as the statute is concerned, or is this something that's being negotiated now that's going to step outside whatever the previous authorization was?
Representative Benz, maybe.
Is, again, the ESA was established to pay certain things.
Yes.
There's a foundation for what those things were. That foundation would be in this old statute. Yes. Is this old statute going to be that which governs the future of the ESA, or is it going to be something that you will negotiate based upon the needs upon the department that may have evolved since this statute was written?
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, that is our hope. The ESA was established in the early 70s, frankly, to assist with nuclear power plant siting. It has evolved to today now generally funding a State Department as well as other activities. You know, not to put, you know, a label, but a lot of creep and a lot of things have happened since 1971 till 2013. This, frankly, is an opportunity to, I wouldn't say do a reset, but certainly look at the agency, its mission, its statutory requirements, what policymakers want to see the agency doing, and then what's the appropriate way and level to fund the agency. That's our hope.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
One more.
Thank you for your indulgence. The challenge, of course, is those who are buying fuel and buying energy are going to allocate a portion to this organization that oversees that which governs. There's a wide variety of things there. So your thought and what we're hearing is that conversation is occurring as we speak, and we're going to see something, or where are we? Are we moving forward?
Representative Benz, that's correct. There's still a lot of spade work to be done on what exactly this bill shapes up as.
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, if I could add, I think in part the transparency and accountability that this bill can hopefully bring will aid in some of those discussions which probably come in the future in the legislature as far as what this body feels should be the statutory authorities that the department should be carrying out in its mission. I don't believe we will decide here now. I believe we will have the kinds of information available to all of us in the legislative context to continue that conversation as things move forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. I have to apologize to the rest of the people who are signed up. I'm going to hold this over. I know we have a lot of people who would like to talk on this. Unfortunately, we have reached that time in session in which we are trying to fit more things into committee hearings than is generally possible, given that we only have two more after this. And given that there is still outstanding work to be done on the amendments here, I think it will be a continuing conversation anyway. So my apologies to those that were here, but I am going to hold over the public hearing on House Bill 2807 and hold over the work session on the House Bill 2807. And with that, close the public hearing on House Bill 2807, having framed the issue, and committee is adjourned.